We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Simon.
And tonight we are going to be looking at the 2003 BBC Big Finish web production of Shada, starring Paul McGann as the Eighth Doctor. The Eighth Doctor returns to Gallifrey, where he meets his old friend and now Lord President Romana. He explains to her that in the 1970s, they'd gone to Cambridge for a reason, but the events of the Five Doctors had interfered with their mission, which they seem to have forgotten about. He convinces her that whatever it was important, and that they hadn't finished it. And so he convinces her and K-9 to return with him to the 1970s Cambridge to finish the adventure. Professor Chronotis, a very old retired Time Lord and friend of the Doctor, has asked him to return a book that he took from Gallifrey when he left. It is a powerful and dangerous book that should never have left Gallifrey. Now, an alien named Skagra is trying to obtain the book, which is somehow the key to finding Shada, the Time Lord prison planet, and a very special prisoner, the Time Lord Sallyavin. So, this is the myth, this is the legend, this is the Doctor Who episode that just won't die.
Well, yes, or that never got to live.
What? Yeah, well, here it is alive, finally.
I think so.
In the background, 1979-1980 series, script editor Douglas Adams, working on Doctor Who, Tom Baker, Lala Ward, the final six-part story of the series was Shada, written by Douglas Adams. And due to an industrial action at Reed Strike at the BBC, the episode was only partially filmed and never got put into production. 2 years later, the footage was taken, the unused footage was taken and used as a way to put Tom Baker into the Five Doctors because he'd refused to come back and participate in the anniversary special. Since then, this footage has bounced around. It's been on videotapes. It's been, they've recently novelized it. It has become sort of this holy grail.
There's more than that, I think, because I mean you mentioned that the fact that we've got it's all the exterior location footage that exists. So we've got that was released on video with Tom Baker doing some linking narration, but the script itself, which obviously still exists, was then used by Douglas Adams as the basis for, along with some of the plot elements from City of Death, which, of course, another of his stories, which did actually get produced in the first of his Dirk Gently books, The Holistic Detective Agency. So in that sense, the story got to live in another format where it then got made into a radio series. It then got reused in the TV pilot not so long ago of the Dirk Gently series on the telly. As you say, there's Gareth Roberts' recently published novelization of it. There's this webcast animation which recasts it with the Eighth Doctor. There's unofficially an animation stroke remounting of the missing bits.
Presumably with somebody doing fake voices.
Well, there's a fake Tom Baker, and I think a fake Chronotis, but other members of the cast come back to do the...
Oh, really?
The characters they did with animation not funded by the BBC, but funded by Ian Levine, and not officially released in any format. So there are a huge number of kind of different versions of this story with and without actually having the Doctor in it, which makes it seem incredibly familiar. Since I pretty much experienced all of those. I haven't actually watched the whole of the unofficially animated reconstruction, but I recently read the Gareth Roberts book, and I've seen the Tom Baker footage. This webcast that we are discussing was also broadcast on BBC Radio as an audio version.
Well, yeah,
also
they made an audio version.
CD as a Big Finish CD. I've heard both of those versions as well.
It's like the most made version of a Doctor Who episode in existence.
I wouldn't be surprised. It certainly seems it must be.
And it's so utterly undeserving of that as to be...
No, that is entirely unfair. I'm a total Douglas Adams fan. I absolutely adore his writing, and especially his novels. Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency is magnificent, and it does have a lot of this story at the heart. I really do enjoy his Doctor Who stuff, and I think it's a real treat to have this. I don't think all the versions of it are equal. Some are better than others, but that in a way justifies the fact that it has been kind of reworked so many times, because there's something good to be got from it, I think.
Let me just. Before I continue on with remarks which will probably be incendiary, when I moved to college in about 1982, shortly thereafter, this was when the Tom Baker invasion of the United States started. So the local television station, public television, started showing the Tom Baker episodes of Doctor Who, which I had already been a fan of John Pertwee's Doctor many years before. So I was, when that came out, I was all over it. And it was very popular. And so they began to bring other things in, although not Blake 7, but they brought in other shows, and one of which was The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Now,
has been adapted in many formats.
Right. And this was the TV with Simon Jones version. And I watched the first episode of that, and I thought it was hilariously funny. And I went to the local bookstore that imported all the Target novelizations for Doctor Who and all the cool Andrew Skillitar posters and stuff. And they had a British import of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy in the novel form, which I purchased. And I took it home and I read it. And I have never laughed so hard before or since reading a book. It just absolutely caught me in the right mood, in the right attitude. It is thunderously hilarious.
It catches everyone like that. I don't think it's anything to do with mood. It's to do with genius.
It does. And unfortunately, none of the others after that, they have amused me, but they have never bowled me over like that one book ever did. Now, I like Douglas Adams' writing. It's absolutely unequivocally a true statement. Most everything I've ever seen Douglas Adams, I have enjoyed and found funny. But I find City of Death, Pirate Planet, and Shada great on my nerves because they are the worst of Tom Baker zany, taken to the universe around him is equally as illogical and zany as he is. It doesn't work for me, and City of Death isn't as bad, but I can't stand Dugan and some of the illogical plot points in there. And Pirate Planet is just, it's got Romana in it, so I like it. But I mean, first Romana, but I mean, it's apart from that, it's like, okay, you've slipped a comedy in on me, and it doesn't gel for me in the Doctor Who universe. But City of Death and Pirate Planet have one thing going for them that Shada does not. They're only four parts long. Shada plods on interminably.
So I'm not going to bother to defend City of Death because the entire Doctor Who fandom has spoken, not to mention the popular television audience, which watched City of Death in greater numbers than any other Doctor Who ever.
I know.
We'll let that speak for itself. The interesting thing about your point about the Fourth Doctor's, the worst of the Fourth Doctor's zaniness. And I've got to say, looking at the kind of surviving footage from Sharda, I really do like Tom Baker's performance in this. And I'm going to come back to that recovered footage because it's one of the few things I do like. This is not in the kind of the webcast version that we're supposed to be discussing. This is not Tom Baker.
But it
this
is.
This has been rewritten for the Eighth Doctor.
Really?
So one of the things I've got is, okay, how well does that work?
I don't feel it has been rewritten. I mean, many of his lines of dialogue sound exactly like what Tom Baker would have said, but they're wrong coming out of his mouth.
Oh, no.
I mean, not the Fourth Doctor, the Eighth Doctor. He doesn't feel like the Eighth Doctor at all to me in these.
See, I'm astonished because I've got a note, you know, just saying this is... You listen to it and you know it's Tom dialogue, partly just, you know, knowing the history of the show and the fact that that's who it was written for. And McGann delivers it in a completely different way to the way that Tom Baker would have done it. And it really, I just think it fits in perfectly. I'm astonished that you don't think that it's good Eighth Doctor material.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like the Eighth Doctor to me. And it's because I can hear Tom's voice saying so many of those lines, and I just don't feel like that's how it would have been presented in other Big Finish Eighth Doctor stories. And it just feels like they tacked on the beginning, and then they just... There are places in this story, for example. Like, once Romana and the Doctor are at Professor Cronitus's lodgings at Cambridge, it feels like they've completely forgotten that Romana is the Lord President, that they came here on a mission, that the Doctor convinced her it was something important. It now just feels like we just took Douglas Adams' dialogue and we said, read it.
It's astonishing how differently you come at it. I've got a note saying how well the new Romana dynamic works in this, you know, updating it for President Romana. There's almost throwaway line that they've added at the point where Romana points out that some of the Doctor's mind is in the sphere, and you know, it's the brilliant suggestion that saves the day, and he says something like, "No wonder they made you president." And again at the end, when the Doctor makes Romana decide what should happen to Sally Avin because it's up to the Time Lords and she is the Lord President. Again, that just feels right to me.
Two or three places like that.
Yeah, but the framing of it, together with the fact that we've got the Lala Ward's portrayal of Romana as the President, which I have to remind myself, because subsequent to this, she did the whole spin-off series for Big Finish, Gallifrey, where she's playing the president, but that came later. At this point, apart from an appearance in the apocalypse element with the Sixth Doctor, she hasn't actually done the presidential thing at all, and yet, boom, it's all there. It feels
that part is fine. I'm fine with that. If we want to break aside and look at the Big Finish, I'm fine with the notion that if Romana ever got back to Gallifrey, she would be the president. Almost in the same way that, even though it's always kind of reluctant or it's a joke, or the Doctor really is the best they've got, and so it would make sense that he would somehow end up as the president if he were there to stay and live on Gallifrey. Romana is his protege and brilliant in her own right. It makes perfect sense. It absolutely makes perfect sense. If she went back to Gallifrey with what she learned being out there in the universe and being with the Doctor, she would take over the planet. I absolutely believe that. Not in a coup or anything like that, but I mean, she would just simply rise to the top. No ifs, ands, or buts. So that's a good fit. I'm not sure about K-9, but what the heck? They had to have him in the story to make it work. But
well, what's she going to do? She's got her K-9. She's not going to.
Well, remember, he could never leave the other universe because he would fall apart. That was the thing in the Warrior's Gate. Humans could travel back and forth, but K-9 would be destroyed if he went through. So that's why he had to stay behind. But how did she get out? We don't know. Maybe there's another way. So I'll accept it. But of course, it could have been Leela's canine.
Yeah, could be.
Actually, so all right. Could well, be. I'll take it.
But I mean, apart from those things, which I really do think work within the story. I have to say, of all the versions of, well, setting aside the kind of non-Doctor versions of the story that came through the kind of Dirk Gently.
See, I think Dirk Gently is a much better version. I think the story works better in its own universe instead of the Doctor Who universe.
Maybe. But it's selective. He stitched together bits of it with bits of City of Time. And
that's what Douglas Adams did so brilliantly in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. He built his own universe.
Yes, I agree. I agree. He's better when he has the freedom to do that. Yes, but that doesn't mean that just like when we've had other authors writing Doctor Who stories, we have had other established authors who are famous for having written other things. Though I suppose actually it was the other way around for Douglas Adams. He was writing Hitchhikers at the same time, I think, as he was Doctor Who script editor.
Thank you.
Anyway, setting that aside, the Doctor Who versions of the Sharda story, I think this is the best one. This is the Eighth Doctor version is my favourite. I think it fits with the Eighth Doctor really well, and the new Romana, but also the whole production, the casting as well. It's a wonderful cast. Edward Fox, Hannah Gordon as the computer. We've got Andrew Sachs as Skagra. Susanna Harker from Ultraviolet, of course. It's a great cast, and it's a great production. And to me, when you compare it as a whole to the bits that we've got left over from the original, apart from the fact that, as I say, I did like what I saw of Tom Baker's performance, I just think this beats it in every respect.
I can't disagree with that. I think it is. I mean, the fact that it's complete helps a lot. But in some ways, yes, I didn't like. There were lots of things about the footage we've seen of Tom Baker's version that I didn't like. But then that's that period of time where I didn't like the set design and didn't like the way they pitched their performances. And so, I mean, I think Skagra in this one is a better villain than that guy that was in the original.
I didn't mention, of course, we have John Leeson as K-9 in this one, which to my ear is a much finer performance than we would have got in the original.
They don't have David Brierley in there. That's right. You know, it's funny. Big Finish has used Brierley, haven't they?
Not to my knowledge.
I thought they had. Well, I guess they haven't done any Romana stuff. So, I mean, they have, but not just
K-9, to my knowledge, I should say.
That's odd. Well, for some reason, I thought they had some with David Brierley, and I thought, oh, that's kind of funny. But no, I guess you're right. K-9's the better voice anyway, but I don't disagree with that. Sorry, John Leeson. See, K-9, he's synonymous. he is the better voice. I had no problem with the performances. I had no problem. I mean, except for the fact that I just feel like the lines they fed McGann just didn't sound like they were coming out of McGann's gob. It was just like, oh yeah, that's a Tom Baker line. It just was like, oh yeah, Tom Baker. It's like when we watch an episode of Doctor Who shortly after Regeneration and we go, well, I just feel like that was written for the previous Doctor.
I know what you mean. I just don't agree. I think McGann owned all of Tom's lines in this.
Huh. Yeah. I wouldn't recommend this story. I would recommend it in its Dirk Gently form better to anyone that wanted.
Well, I'm not going to say don't read Dirk Gently. Dirk Gently is fantastic, but I would definitely recommend this story. And you know, looking at the animations that we've looked at in this series so far, this is far and away the best of the three.
Yes, and there's one other thing I actually have in my notes about this, is that I think, and this is, I know that these characters are based largely on the people. Susanna Harker looks like Susanna Harker in a dog collar, which is an unusual fashion choice. And I assume that they've, you know, perhaps taken a little bit from some of those characters. Lala Ward looks so much better in this than she did in actual Doctor Who.
Oh.
Which is funny, really. It's like, you know, the animated version of her with the short hair, she's prettier than she was back
you,
in the day.
You have a strange Romana bias.
I do have, well, I don't have a strange Romana bias. I like the first one better. That's certainly not a strange bias, but I stand by it. I think the animated one looks better than it. I don't think she looked bad in the show. I just think that she does look more presidential.
Yes. Yes.
I think
it works well.
So, and yes, the artwork is better and the animation is a little bit more animated, not much.
It has become more sophisticated, I think. I mean, it's the same artist as the other two. So, similar style of drawing, which is fine. You know, I liked it well enough before. But we do get slightly more movement. So things like doors opening, and previously any kind of movement would be a dissolve from one, like you were going from one panel in a cartoon strip to another panel, mm-hmm. dissolving from one to the other. And now we actually see some movement, like
flappy arms
trundling or eyebrows raising or pages of a book turning, or at one point you even see tea being poured and steam coming off.
Yeah.
But it still feels pretty basic, and in particular you notice the fact that there's no lip sync going on, because obviously you have characters' faces in shot while they're speaking, but their mouth is static.
Right.
But which is, you know, well,
we're progressing. I think they got more colors.
It's progressing. I mean, in a way, because looking at the much, much more recent animation for the remounting, the filling the gaps of the original, the drawings in it are fine. The animation in principle is a lot more sophisticated because it actually does have lip sync. But although the drawings look good, the actual animation is incredibly difficult to watch, I find, because it's very, very... It's quite sort of functional. I studied animation briefly, and we learned about things like the having things stretch and the kind of the way in which a movement flows and things like this. But you look at the animation in that, and it's very, very minimal and quite jarring. Ironically, if you look at the less sophisticated animation in this older webcast, although it is less sophisticated, it is easier to look at, if that makes any sense at all.
Well, so, I mean, we're jumping ahead here a little bit, but because I've not seen the animation that you're talking about, but are you referring to, say, some of the recreation animations that we have later on use a technique where they have built an animation model that, to me, kind of looks like a paper doll with brads or rivets at the joint points, so they can just sort of spin them around as movement, like a paper doll.
Yeah, but I don't think that automatically means that you're going to get poor animation from it. It's not about
poor animation, though.
Well, I mean, it is partly about your models, because it's partly about choosing where the movements are, and, you know, without getting too technical in it, what the frames and the joints and what moves and what doesn't. But it is also about the paths and the fluidity of the moves that get made. You know, how suddenly they start and stop and all this kind of thing. And the animation in this, although it is basic, is quite fluid. So although they don't attempt to, for example, make the lips move while people are speaking, when we do see movements, because it's all very simply done, it doesn't seem, you don't expect realism, but the movement seems acceptable, if that.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's well chosen when they animate something.
Yes. Yes. The movements that they choose to make are done well.
And they've chosen movements that are easy for them to do.
And do well, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So. The only kind of criticism I had of the animation that we got here, which was something that did feature in the previous ones, but it's the impressionistic stuff. It's things like when characters are talking about a book, a book kind of pans across, not in the sense of we're actually seeing a book now. It's just it's a kind of thematic thing. They talk about book, we'll see a book on screen. And sometimes the backdrop disappears, you know, when they're having a conversation, we just see a starscape behind them or whatever. And those kind of impressionistic things worked better when the animation felt more basic, because it's starting to get a bit more realism in it, in this one. Those seem to be a little, conversely, those actually seem to be a little bit more jarring, I thought.
Is the Big Finish audio version only different than this? Because I did notice...
Not very different.
One or two places where I felt like we spent way too much time looking at the non-existing animation. You know, the picture. Like, okay, there's a room full of crawls or whatever they are. Crogs. What are they? Crawls? Crogs?
Crogs.
Crogs. And they're just all sort of flapping their arms a little bit. And if this had been an audio play, I would have walked... checked out by that point, if I didn't have anything in front of my eyes. So I felt like they were just most of the time it sounded like a straight up radio program, but every once in a while I was thinking, oh yeah, okay, this can't be what they've done on audio, because if they have, they're not supplying me any information at this point.
I think it was. I don't know the exact point you're referring to, but it's pretty close in all of it. So, I mean, I've said what I like about the animation in this one, and obviously the animation is the reason we're looking at this, because we're looking at the animated story, so that's right. What brings it into our sights for casting our critical eye over. Ultimately, I still have to say, though, it is a fail in the sense that I would rather not have it. I would rather just listen to it as an audio story. And just close my eyes. And in fact, because I was watching the webcast version on the BBC website, some of those files are missing, chapters from episodes are missing, at which point I would then switch to the CD version and listen to that instead and enjoy it a little bit more as a result of, you know, being able to basically focus on listening to the audio and letting the images come from that, than trying to kind of fill in the gaps or allow my visual imagination to make up for the lack of sophistication, if you like, in the drawings that we get.
Hmm.
There was one thing I noticed when you are talking about differences, where I did actually think, that's interesting, I will check that. Which was where Skagra comes back to his ship in episode one, and he asks the computer, who is this doctor person, or words to that effect, and she shows a load of Gallifreyan symbols that he kind of stares at for, felt like a minute, but probably 20 seconds or something, during which there's no dialogue. And I thought, well, you can't possibly have that on audio, because then he reacts to that, and so on audio... What's the reaction?
Well, that was a chance to show pictures of the old doctors.
Yeah, well, yes, yeah. Which is interesting, because when on the CD version, that does actually have snippets of audio with the Seventh Doctor and Mel, and the Sixth Doctor and Evelyn, and the Fifth Doctor, and you can actually pick up which Big Finish productions they're from. But you can also probably guess that's why they didn't use it on the BBC website for rights mm-hmm. reasons. And indeed, when it got broadcast on Radio 7, they couldn't use it for that either, but they needed to fill in with something else. So for that, they used snippets of audio from earlier in episode 1. So you hear bits of the Eighth Doctor on there. So all three versions are actually subtly different in at least one respect. I can confirm that.
So let's just kick the idea of animation around for a second here. Television, at least in the United States, came up very much out of the old radio industry. So people used to listen to radio. They used to listen to weekly shows. Like you would the Archers now, perhaps daily, perhaps weekly, whatever. Many of the famous shows from the early times of American television are, in fact, directly just moving the radio programs into the visual medium.
Absolutely true here, yeah.
And it has been said, and I will confirm that I have tested this to see if it's true, that for the most part, television is radio with pictures, and that you can walk out of a room, at least television from the 60s and 70s, you can walk out of a room and you can listen to it in the background and you can get 95 to 100% of what's yeah. going on without having to look at the visual at all. Now, as we've progressed further and further from radio, I think there's more visual going on in TV now, and it's not as easy to do. Partially
yes,
because of the way they edit faster and...
Yes, I think that's true, but I would argue that I think that is fairly recent as well. Like, you know, maybe the last 15 to 20 years,
yes.
no more.
Yes, I think it's evolving away from the old radio paradigm a little.
Because here, I mean, you can almost test it in a sense. You have certain things that were... So originally, I mean, I probably know more about comedy and sitcoms than I do about drama, but because things like Hancock's Half Hour or whatever would have started on the radio and then gone on to television, just like you describe, you know, it's a successful show on the radio, that's the progression. That happened with all sorts of things, you know, going through, I can think of umpteen sitcoms, Second Thoughts, things like Radioactive becoming KYTV, etc., etc. That carried on right through to the 80s. In the meantime, you got, particularly before VHS came along, you got things that were TV soundtracks released on record. Fawlty Towers, for example, mm-hmm. was available on LP over here. There's pretty little difference between the LP release, which is a straight take of the soundtrack. Number of shows, things like Dad's Army or Yes Minister or whatever, were re-recorded as radio versions, but again, not much done to the script. And even in the 80s, we get things like Blackadder getting released on audio cassette. That's straight taking the audio soundtrack. So I think there's a huge amount of evidence to say that holds up. Absolutely.
Now, one of the interesting things about Britain is that you didn't get rid of the radio and we did.
Well, yeah.
Which, you know, I'm not... I would say that's a better thing. I like having that, but it is by and large gone here. And so we don't have really anybody who is growing up gets radio as a medium anymore to then transition into television. But that's, you know, that's just the vagaries. But so here's my question then. Why did they do this as an animation?
You mean rather than doing it as an audio?
Yeah.
I do think that is a very interesting question, and I think we touched on something somewhat revealing in the discussion around Death Comes to Time, which was the fact that was originally pitched to Radio 4, and Radio 4 turned it down. There'd already been successful new Doctor Who on Radio 2 with the John Pertwee stories in the first Wilderness years.
Mm-hmm.
And my guess, I mean, the honest answer is I have absolutely no idea. My guess is that there was money in the web. at this point. Well, I mean, not that there isn't now, but that far-sighted people in the BBC who were paid to look at the future and to recognise what it would look like saw that the web was something that would need to grow without necessarily knowing what should go in it. And so there were budgets for
experimenting, I'm guessing.
These kinds of somewhat experimental things, and therefore people casting around for what will we do. And at the same time, the people who were desperate to make some new Doctor Who couldn't get it made on TV, couldn't get it made on the radio. Hey, these people in web, they've got money, they've got open minds, and so in a way that they become the go-to people, especially after you have what seemed to have been two other successful stories. I don't know. I do. One of the people say that the other webcasts were successful, and that's what led to them making more. And indeed, they go on to make another one after this. The only thing that makes me question that is the fact that they never do quite the same thing twice. So Death Comes to Time is a very sort of, shall we be kind and say, original take on what might be interpreted as the current Doctor, if you kind of scribble out the Eighth Doctor from history. Then they switch, and I think more successfully, to real time, which does what the John Pertwee stories on Radio 2 had done, which is go back into past Doctor Who continuity and insert something into the old canon.
Mm-hmm.
Then with this one, we go back to, in the choice of Doctor, the very latest Doctor. All we've seen is the Eighth Doctor in the TV movie on screen at this point. That's all we've seen.
Is this now before he did his other Big Finish stuff?
No, he'd already been doing Big Finish stuff. Okay. But I think it's fair to say that it being a BBC production even on the web would have meant it got a much, much larger audience than the typical Big Finish stuff going out on cassette or CD or whatever. Plus, you know, there are only three on-screen appearances of the Eighth Doctor: the beginning, the end, and this is all we've got from the middle, where we actually have the Eighth Doctor appearing on screen. But it's not just going with the latest Doctor. It's also, as you say, it is the legendary Doctor Who story that never was, the one thing that the fans want to see completed, which is why they keep completing it again and again and again.
Indeed. You see, now I'm going to divert here for just one second, because it brought something to my mind, and I'm going to throw it out there, and I know you're going to reject the idea, but at the same time,
I might accept it.
I might be taking a swipe at Douglas Adams here. One of the things about Douglas Adams' work the reason I didn't think it was as funny in later books is that I felt he was retreading a lot. And so the question is the similarities between Shada and Dirk Gently because Shada hadn't got finished, or because Douglas Adams didn't have as many ideas as perhaps the bottomless well of originality that people think he is? And I kind of feel like there's a little...
I want to listen to you. I want to give that idea due consideration. But yeah, I'm going to object.
Things show up over and over again in his work. The same kinds of...
Yeah, well, every author has themes. Every author has themes. But it's not because Shada didn't get made that because in Dirk Gently, he reuses City of Death, which did get made. But they were good ideas, and more than that, they fitted within the Dirk Gently story he was writing. He then wrote another Dirk Gently story, an even better Dirk Gently story, that was entirely original. So it wasn't as if he couldn't come up with good original ideas. It was just, why would you throw a good idea away? And obviously the other thing, the famous thing about Douglas Adams is that he did have slight problems with deadlines. So he might
slight.
Yeah. Well, as you said, I love the whooshing sound they make as they go past. He would spend his time in his bath thinking, and I guess in a panic maybe he did dig up something from an unused idea. I mean, I think the classic example would be Life, the Universe and Everything, which is this is the third novel in the Hitchhiker series, and the plot is another Doctor Who story that never got made.
This is the Cricket Robot Warriors, right?
Yeah. In that case, I think you can really see the how thin it is in places, and in particular the fact that because he didn't have a replacement for the character, the role played by the Doctor in the original story, he chucks a character from the first Hitchhiker's novel, Slarty Bartfast, into it. But his role is completely against character in that story, so it doesn't quite work. I don't know if we allow there is any truth in what you say, that, you know, sometimes he does retread themes, whether that makes Sharda any weaker a story, because it is the original. At the point when the script for Sharda was written, the ideas in it had not been used for anything else.
True dat. I will acknowledge that was the first go round. I do still think it was retreaded better, but anyway.
I'm not denying that Dirk Gently is very, very good. But I like the story, and I particularly like this production of it.
What about the character? We'll talk a little bit about the characters therein. Professor Chronoitus. Does that make sense? I mean, apart from the fact... His whole... Well, any of it. He's this villain who escapes, and then he lives in Cambridge in a TARDIS, and people forget him all the time, and he's incredibly potty-minded. Not potty-minded. Potty. Yeah, potty, that's the right word. Suddenly the toilet association hit me. That's not what I meant. As in... wacky.
He's potty.
He's
absent-minded.
He desperately... His mind is taken, right? He fights it, but his mind is sort of taken. He goes to Sharda with them, and when they find the empty thing, the empty sarcophagus-y thing, and Sally Avon's not in it, and it looks like the trail is dead and cold, and Skagra's never going to get what he wants, and oh darn, the universe is safe. And he goes, "That's because I escaped from it." It's like, why did you tell him that? And why didn't he know that already? And it's like, these are the things about Douglas Adams stories. I mean, apart from the fact that he makes a universe that doesn't quite fit with the rest of the universe that we know, but then it just doesn't kind of make any sense to me. What's happening there? And
well, he goes there to try and stop Skagra from
finding out that he's escaped.
That Sally Avon escaped. To me, that makes perfect sense.
That part,
the criticism, because I don't think it is a perfect story, and I think I would agree actually that I think Dirk Gently is a much more tightly constructed story, and in particular the criticism I would level at this story is, it's another bloody Doctor Who about bloody Time Lords from Gallifrey. And here's another Time Lord villain, Time Lord exile, living in Cambridge. The brilliant thing about Reg Chronotis in the Dirk Gently story is that he is much more what he seems, which is, he is this eccentric Cambridge don who happens to be living in a room in a college, and no one has noticed the fact that he has a time machine and has been around for several hundreds of years. And Douglas Adams just gets away with that by saying that he really can't remember who he was or how he came to be there, because obviously he had a story for that in the that fitted in the Doctor Who universe. And suddenly it works a lot better. I mean, it works a lot better without all of that Time Lord baggage in my mind. So that you are touching there on what I would have to say, you know, the whole renegade criminal refugee, or however you want to put it, plus the ancient and worshipful law and the Time Lord prison planet stuff. It's all stuff that I don't particularly enjoy in Doctor Who, but at the same time, it's not like Douglas Adams is the only person who's done it.
Right. So now I'm gonna have to admit something here before we go too terribly further. I have watched the reconstruction of the show. I have the recently released novel. I gave it to Michelle first. She put it down after the second chapter and wouldn't pick it up again. I made it through three before I put it down and haven't picked it up again.
That bad, is it?
I don't like this story. I really do not. I like the story. Sort of nonsense story, and I don't really care for it. And the novel didn't. I was hoping that it wasn't. When I picked it up, I had not seen this webcast. When I picked it up and started reading it, I was thinking, you know, finally I'm going to figure out what this amazing story is, because I don't appreciate it in its discombobulated form with the cut up pieces and stuff. It doesn't enthrall me. And I got through it and it's like, no, it actually doesn't. It just doesn't enthrall me. So I don't know for a fact, because I don't think it's addressed in the reconstruction, or if it is, I've forgotten it. But it is addressed in this web version, and that is that Skagra is from a race of people who are descended from the Gallifreyans. Is that the way it is across the board? Because that was just that little bit about the schism there, which sounds a lot like the schism in the Catholic Church in the medieval ages. And so no, he went off to another planet, and they set up a colony of...
It was Salyavin who went off to another planet.
No. They ask who Skagra was, and... right at the end, and the doctor says, well, it was this other guy went to this other planet.
Salyavin went to the other planet. Skagra comes from the planet that Salyavin went to.
I thought that... I didn't think it was Skagra that went to the planet, but I thought that this other priest guy, or wannabe president, or prime minister of Gallifrey, or head of the Gallifreyan church, or whatever it was, under that schism, he went and established a Gallifreyan colony on this other planet. That's what I got out of the end of this. And it's like, and Skagra is from that planet. Does that mean he's a descendant? Is that why he knew all this stuff? Or then why doesn't he read Gallifreyan? I don't know.
He's from that planet. So he knows all this stuff because it's part of the planet. It's part of the history of the planet, his home planet.
Hmm. Okay.
As I understand it, I think there may have been slightly more about it in the book. So, but my memory of it may not be perfect. I may have made some error in my recollection there.
Were the characters of Chris and Claire, did they contribute a lot to this story, or were they just kind of hangers-on most of the time? Chris in particular. Claire at least did something. At one point.
I don't know. I mean...
This is why I feel like this would have improved at four episodes. I don't think there was enough story here to cover six.
It's only six episodes because they're six short episodes.
But it would have been six.
It would have been six in the original. That is true. And yeah, probably it could have done with some trimming. I can't help thinking, and maybe this is partly the result of having read too many versions of the story, but I can't help thinking of Chris as being the Richard Macduff character from Dirk Gently, which is obviously partly, for those who haven't seen the webcast version, Chris is cast in this. He's played by Sean Bickerstaff, so he's recast as a Glaswegian, and Macduff is obviously Scottish as well. So in the TV version, the Doctor keeps referring to him as Bristol, and they kind of drop that on the basis that there isn't a Bristol in Scotland. So what does Richard Macduff bring to, what does Richard Macduff bring to the Dirk Gently story? He's kind of the eyes through which we see Dirk and
see and
yeah.
We don't need that in the Doctor Who story because we have our
maybe
audience,
not. Although I, you know, we've gone over this before, and it's something I quite like. I don't know. I didn't have a problem with Claire and Chris's characters in this. I didn't like it so much in the Gareth Roberts version, where he goes big on the Chris Claire romance, which is better, I think, left understated, as it is in the dramatized versions.
I didn't even pick up on it. So,
I mean, because it's a book, he describes all their it kind of in a. So, I mean, because it is a novelization of a TV story, and I'm not a big fan on the whole. There are exceptions, but I'm not a big fan on the whole of Doctor Who prose. And part of the reason for that is that I think a lot of the novelizations are very, very descriptive, trying to explain what you would be seeing, either what you would be seeing if you were watching the story on TV, if it is indeed a novelization of a TV story, or if it's an original story, they almost read as if they are a novelization of an imagined, unmade TV story. You have to be a very good writer. You have to be Douglas Adams, essentially, to be able to get away with that. And, of course, Douglas Adams always elected not to novelise his Doctor Who stories, and I think not to allow anyone else to, because certainly they never did.
Oh, Terence Dix could have done the job.
His lifetime.
He could have done it. No, you know, one thing about the writing of Douglas Adams is that I could envision, actually, in a Douglas Adams novel version of it, I could envision the romance of Claire and Chris being played up. Not in as much as played up during the course of the story, but in flashback, because that strikes me as the kind of thing Douglas Adams would do. He would then suddenly refer to the time they were in a coffee shop or something. In
the biscuits.
That feels like Douglas Adams to me, and I wonder if they did that, if Gareth Roberts was trying to capture the feel of Douglas Adams successfully.
Well, I'm sure he was trying to capture the feel of Douglas Adams, but I mean, it's not like I think he invented a romance that wasn't there. It's just something, I guess, that it's harder to be as. It's harder to underplay it, perhaps, in prose. Certainly within his style of writing, these things seem to get laid out. The thoughts of the character seem to get laid out a lot more. But yeah, there you go. Yet another version of this story.
So I have a feeling I know where we stand. But what's your final thoughts on this Shada, any Shada? Shada as a whole.
I like Shada. I don't necessarily think that either Douglas Adams's Doctor Who is the best Doctor Who, though it rates pretty highly, I would say. Nor do I necessarily think that Douglas Adams's Doctor Who is the best Douglas Adams. But I like it, and I like the story of Shada when it is realised well. And the audio version of this, the kind of soundtrack from this webcast, is undoubtedly, in my mind, by some fair margin, the best realisation of the Shada story. As an animation, it's better than what we've had, again, by quite a long margin. But it's still a fail in the sense of I'd much rather shut my eyes and listen to it.
Well, I think I've come down. I'm not a fan of. I mean, I have no objection to the performances casting. I just think that this just isn't a particularly great story. I think that had the original been made, it nestles very, very neatly in with its siblings, Nightmare of Eden, Creature from the Pit, Horns of Nyman.
I can't imagine what you're saying.
I'd say that they have a, they are of a kind. and I would say that City of Death is the best of that season. I have never quite understood why it's so highly rated fan-wise across the gamut of classic Doctor Who. But as you so rightly point, it is. I think it's just because people don't give it a lot of thought. I think it's just like, yeah, it's funny. Hey, they're in Paris. Gosh, they look like they're having a lot of fun. I mean, Julian Glover is great. Catherine Schell is as beautiful as always. And it's like, all right, we're having fun here. But it doesn't make a lot of sense.
We get that you don't like City of Death. We can accept your wrongness on that. do you think that Sharda is any worse than the rest of the season? And
I don't think it's worse. I think it's very contemporary with it. I think it has very much the same kind of would be in the same kind of place in my mind with the rest of Doctor Who. I mean, I actually kind of enjoy Creature from the Pit and Horns of Nyman and Nightmare of Eden, but they're certainly not top of the barrel Doctor Who either. They are what they are.
I agree, and I said much the same thing a few moments ago. I think they are very enjoyable stories, but I take it then given that you recognize that City of Death and this kind of particular era, the sort of Douglas Adams, Graham Williams era of the show, is quite highly regarded, at least by a section of the Doctor Who fandom, that might, and if Sharda is of a muchness with those stories, that might explain the kind of mythos, if you like, that surrounds Sharda, and that it does relate to that kind of yearning to see the story made, or wishful thinking that it had been made, does relate to the story itself, and isn't due to the kind of there's a supposed effect, isn't there, of the lost stories? You know, in the way that people say Tomb of the Cybermen was thought to be excellent up to the point where it was discovered, and then everyone watched it, and then everyone thought, "Oh, it wasn't that good."
I liked it.
which incidentally, I mean, I've heard that said. I think it's rubbish because I really, really love Tomb of the Cybermen. I think it is a top notch story, and it was a wonderful thing that it was found. And everyone who thought it was brilliant or assumed it was brilliant was absolutely right.
Well, what about Enemy of the World, which everyone thought was terrible until it came out. I really liked that one.
Well, yeah. Okay, interesting. So I think we're probably agreeing that there is no kind of I don't quite know how to describe it, but no effect from it, the fact it is a lost story, giving people a kind of rose-tinted view of what it would have been like had it been made, or what it could be like if it could only in some way be remounted.
I feel it does. I mean, I think that there are people who think this is much better than it is. Like I said,
those are people who like season 17. So and you think they're wrong for liking season 17. But if they think it's as good as the rest of season 17, and you think it's as good as the rest of season 17, perhaps that's all there is to it, and there's none of this kind of extra rose-tinted stuff, which is due to the fact that it was never made.
I've never actually heard anyone say they liked season 17, but before. I mean, as a whole, if you put
you can bet you will now. Someone's going to write someone in.
Compared to all the other Tom, except for the John Nathan Turner stuff at the end, which was pretty dire. But I mean, up to that point, season 17 was the point when they went too far across the line. And Nathan Turner pulled it back too far, but it was building up better and better as it went, and 17 was where the turn came. And towards silly, towards Tom Baker apparently having no restraints on him whatsoever.
so So let me put the question a different way then. If Shada, in a parallel universe, if Shada had been made and there had been no strike or you know, it had been viable to remount and continue filming, if it had been made, do you think it would have had a lesser reputation than what I think is a fairly high, although there is really no kind of definitive version of it, the story itself has a pretty high reputation and interest in fandom. Do you think if it had been made, then that would have been destroyed?
I think it would be a fairly unmemorable, unremembered story. Yes. I think it would be like, eh, and there was Shada. But, like I said, that's the impression I get from, you know, and then there was Creature from the Pit. I mean, except that people remember that for the big phallic-shaped creature. Or and then there was Horns from Nimrod, but that's remembered for that incredible performance by the scientific bad guy with his
Graham Crowden.
Yeah, with his accent.
It's fabulous.
And his funny.
It's fabulous.
It's a funny performance.
Yes,
but it's
highly entertaining.
That's not why I'm trying to remember the story. And then there's the not Nightmare of Eden, the Horns of Nimrod with. Those bad costumes and that incredibly over-the-top performance by the guy doing the thing. Those are the things that people remember about those stories. Not like, you know, that was a pretty good story. They don't remember that. They remember, oh yeah, that one. It's kind of like you remember the CGI in, or the CSO in Underworld. It's like, oh, that episode. Cool. Anyway. Well, I suspect that we have a different opinion of where Shada would go on the list of Tom Baker episodes if I numbered them out. It would not be last. It wouldn't be in the top half, though.
I don't know. I mean, actually, just to conclude that thought, I think I've just thinking about it, when you say where would you number it as a Tom Baker episode, I do realize I don't think it would have deserved as much the reputation it has had it been made at the time, because, as I said earlier, I don't think that the surviving footage shows the story itself being realised as strongly as it then was later on during this big finished production of it, which I think casts the story in a much better light. And it would have been difficult, I think, to separate it out from its production. So, yeah, probably... You know, if you ask me that, where I put it on the list of the Tom Baker stories, it would slip down if it were on a list of Tom Baker stories, because the production itself wasn't that hot.
You know, I'll pass this on with regards to the Paul McGann performance then, because you made me rethink it slightly. I feel like he is saying word for word Tom Baker's lines. It just feels like he's saying them word for word Tom Baker's lines. At the same time, he is not giving it a Tom Baker performance. And so they come off to me, they just don't feel right because they are Tom Baker's words being said. But that said, I think the story benefits from being less silly because of McGann's performance. It is a little bit more serious. So in that respect, yeah, probably is McGann's performance is in a way better as this production goes. Because it needed to be less silly. It's got enough silly in it already. So, I guess I'll agree this is probably the best of all possible Doctor Who versions of Shada that we have to choose from. But I'll go watch something else now just to get some proper good story or something. I think
Scream of Shelter, I would think.
Well, I might go watch Seeds of Death or something that I consider in the more... The Seeds of Death or Seeds of Doom? Which one's the Tom Baker one? I can never remember. It must be Seeds of Doom. No, it might be Seeds of Death. They should never have allowed two episodes to be named virtually the same.
Yeah, at least, well, in Torchwood, they've got Day One as the name of two episodes, so it's not quite that bad.
It's not quite that bad. Well, one's a number one and one's written out, right?
No. Is it?
I don't know. I don't know, I'm just making that up. All right, well, next time, is it Scream of the Schalke?
Scream of Schalke, yes.
Schalke. All right, I'll have to get that.
Was
now.
It the Schalke?
I don't know.
Have I always been misreading that? You might be right.
I thought it was the.
Yeah, I think. No, I think you might be right now.
You know, it'd be like Genesis of Daleks. It just doesn't flow. You gotta have the. I've not seen that one, so I'll have to.
Schalke, Schalke, Skagra.
I don't like his naming convention either. Douglas Adams, Jagaroth, Skagra, Salyavin, Skaroth. He just
Vogons, Dentrassi.
Well, those aren't as bad. But yeah, there's something similar about City of Death, and I'm trying to think of Pirate Planet. We really never got anybody's name. The captain, the nurse, what's his name with the curly hair? Mr. Fibuli. Yeah, anyway. All right, well, Simon, thank you for joining me.
It's a pleasure, as always.
And listeners, we hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol. Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us, leave us a review on iTunes. Or stop by and visit at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Search for Fusion Patrol. Or just drop us a note at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.